This is a CBC podcast.
Hi there, I'm JP Tasker, and this is the Power and Politics podcast for Friday, March 22nd. Catherine, the Princess of Wales, says she is being treated for cancer. We'll get reaction to the news from a royal watcher. And Power and Politics host David Cochrane is in Montreal for Brian Mulroney's state funeral. He brings us an interview with Ben Mulroney, son of the late Prime Minister. But first, the Conservatives failed to topple the government over the carbon tax. The Power Panel weighs in on the political fallout. We're going to start today with breaking news. Catherine, the Princess of Wales, is being treated for an undisclosed form of cancer.
As you can imagine, this has taken time. It has taken me time to recover from major surgery in order to start my treatment. But most importantly, it has taken us time to explain everything to George, Charlotte and Louis in a way that's appropriate for them and to reassure them that I'm going to be okay. As I've said to them, I am well and getting stronger every day by focusing on the things that will help me heal in my mind, body and spirits.
Earlier this year, Kensington Palace announced the princess had undergone a planned abdominal surgery, prompting weeks of speculation over her health and whereabouts. Her statement explains that when she had that surgery, it was not known there was any cancer. No further details on the type of cancer has been disclosed, but Kensington Palace says it's confident the princess will make a full recovery. Royal commentator Patricia Treble is watching this story with us, and she joins us now. Patricia, welcome back to the show.
Thanks, JP.
So after months of mystery, we have some answers today about the princess. What do we know about her condition and the path ahead for her?
Well, we know that she's undergoing what is called preventative chemotherapy. That, you know, when she had the abdominal surgeries you talked about in January, they didn't find cancer when they did the tests at the time. It was only later when they're doing post-surgery tests, the further ones, that they did find that there was cancer. And then they had to figure out the course of treatment, and as they said in the statement, her doctors decided on preventative chemotherapy. And there are echoes, of course, to the king. The king had, you know, a prostate enlargement treatment. It was assumed to be benign, and only later did tests reveal that he had cancer, not prostate cancer. And he's undergoing treatment in London. And so you've got, as you said, two major royals. I mean, this is, you know, the monarch and the wife of the heir to the throne are both undergoing, you know, treatment for cancer at the same time. And of course, he's 75, she's 42, mother of three young kids. And that's got to be the focus. It was the focus of the video, and it must be the focus for her and William right now.
There's been so much chatter, as you know, about this, about the alleged doctored images coming out of Kensington Palace, you know, Kate's decision to step back spawned so many conspiracy theories. We saw that all over social media over the last few weeks. Do you think that this announcement today puts some of that to bed?
Oh, I hope so. I mean, social media has been really driving this story for a number of weeks now. And look, they were clear in January. They said, you know, she'll be back when she's back. They thought at that time it was going to be late. It was going to be after Easter. But I kind of have a bone to pick, if I can say that, with all those conspiracy theories, because it wasn't just, you know, people who are prone to it, but like it seemed like everyone was jumping into it, you know, feet first down the rabbit hole. And people were, you know, going at her in a way that just felt, you know, over the top. Yes, you know what? The photo was a mistake. It was a family photo. She reached out to it. She shouldn't have done that. It was a family photo. I think we can all, you know, she admitted it, and there we go. But everyone just kind of went into overdrive. And now we know that at that time, she's undergoing chemotherapy treatment. And I've got to say, it shows you just the fact that in today's society, we abhor vacuum. And when we don't get the news that we want, we'll fill it with whatever is out there.
The royal family, I don't have to tell you this, is facing quite a bit of turmoil. Of course, we've got the ongoing Harry and Meghan issue. Prince Andrew has been removed as a working royal. King Charles himself has cancer and is in treatment, as you mentioned. And now, of course, his daughter-in-law, the future Queen Catherine, stricken with cancer. That's a lot of working royals out of the mix. What does this mean for the institution?
Yeah. I mean, we were always going to face a crisis in the fact that a lot of the working royals are getting, you know, visibly older. And especially with Harry and Meghan gone, it is very noticeable. William and Kate are the only ones under 50 right now, of all the working royals. But what we've also seen is people adapting. So Queen Camilla has been stepping up. She was just in Scotland. She was just in Northern Ireland, taking on an increasingly visible role. We're also seeing other members of the family that we don't normally see. They don't normally get a lot of attention. So Princess Anne rarely has media with her when she's doing her myriad engagements, and she works very hard. But also Prince Edward and Sophie. And I think it's simply adaptation. You're seeing the king do lots of photos, lots of videos, because, of course, he can't appear in front face and public facing engagements because he's undergoing chemo. And so you adapt and you go through. They're thinking long term about this. And in the long term, you know, 10 or 20 years, probably 20 years, we've got three young kids who are probably going to become working royals.
All right, Patricia, thank you so much for sharing your insights with us. I appreciate you coming on.
Oh, you're welcome, JP.
The federal government is giving Ontario until the end of day today to come up with a housing plan, or else the province risks losing more than $350 million in federal funding. This comes after Premier Doug Ford's announcement that the province won't automatically approve the building of fourplexes.
This is a no-brainer. You don't put 4, 6, 8-story buildings in the middle of a community of single-dwelling homes. Go out, ask anyone with a home here, do you want a 4-story or 6-story tower behind you? Absolutely they don't.
Ontario NDP leader Merritt Stiles joins me now. Welcome back to the show.
Great to be here.
So Ontario is in the throes of a housing crisis, and Premier Doug Ford has said automatically allowing fourplexes province-wide is off the table. He doesn't want that sort of density everywhere. Did he make the right call on this one?
No, absolutely not. It's outrageous for Doug Ford to dismiss a good, smart housing solution like fourplexes in the midst of a housing crisis. And in fact, you know, as I've said earlier this week, I think his comments are deeply insulting as well to so many Ontarians. He's essentially telling people that anyone who can't afford a single detached home, well, they're not welcome in the neighborhood. So I think it's outrageous. I think it's insulting. And it's certainly not going to help us to build the housing that we desperately need in this province.
The Premier's point is that there will be a lot of homeowners up in arms when densification comes to their neighborhood. It could ruin the character of some of these more established places in the province. Does he have a point? There could be a lot of blowback. It could create a lot of animosity and anxiety and trouble in some neighborhoods right across the province.
Well, I think, first of all, that we've been on this road for a while now. And what we're hearing and what I'm hearing from Ontarians everywhere I go across this province, small towns, big cities, everywhere, is desperation for housing, right? We can't recruit people to come and work in our communities, and we can't find a place for them to live to stay there. It's a really bad situation. And so I think that it's completely out of touch of Doug Ford to not recognize that we need these solutions. And look, absolutely, sometimes communities aren't all that keen, but we're talking about fourplexes. And some of the Premier's comments over the last few days lead me to think he doesn't really even know what that is. A lot of people live in fourplexes. I've lived in fourplexes. Many people live in fourplexes. It's a solution that I think is not inconsistent with, you know, belongs in many communities. And I think Ontarians are ready for that. They want to see solutions. It's impacting so many of us. And the government can't shut the door on that. And, you know, I'll add to one more thing, which is what the Premier's failing to do here as well is show some bold leadership and meet the moment. I think people are looking for that. They want real leadership from their Premier, and they're not getting it.
You don't think the Premier knows what a fourplex is?
Well, when he was asked about it the other day, he made it sound like it was always going to be a 4-story tower. And that's not the case, right? I mean, I make it look like this. It's a box, divide it down the middle, divide it in half. This is a fourplex. And those exist in many communities. And I think, again, it's showing that he doesn't really understand or chooses not to understand what this is it's going to take to build the density we need. And the other thing about this, right, is people want options. We have to have options. Not everybody is going to be able to afford a detached single-family home. So we need options. We need more affordable and attainable options. And this government is ignoring many of the options that we have out there, the solutions that have been presented to us by experts. And it's very disappointing.
There could be consequences to this decision and some of the other housing decisions they've taken over the last little while. The federal government coming out today saying that if the province does not come up with a new housing plan, they risk losing $350 million for affordable housing. There's a bit of a threat from Ottawa. That's a lot of money. How do you think the Ford government should proceed? Should they just leave this $350 million on the table, or should they change course?
Well, look, in Ontario, it's true. And under the Ford Conservatives, housing starts are down. They aren't up. Housing has never been so expensive. And as you said, we learned today that the Ford Conservative government here in Ontario is not meeting those federal affordable housing targets. We need those to meet those targets to qualify for that federal housing money. And I think that Ontarians are going to be deeply disappointed to think that the government is making a choice here. Not to find solutions like that, not to find the funding to be able to help us build the affordable housing we need. And, you know, let's face it too, right? It's been 30 years since this province and the country, frankly, started to actually get back, build housing themselves. So governments used to build housing. Governments used to build affordable housing, rent geared to income, co-op housing. We need to get back into that again. And it's one of the things that we in the NDP have been calling for.
I think Canadian Mortgage and Housing Corporation data suggested that there was a slight uptick in housing starts in Toronto last year. But I take your point about across the province, we're certainly not meeting we're not meeting demand. And nationwide, the problem is huge. We need many millions
more. And of course,
have
a new mayor. And we have a new mayor in Toronto who's actually been taking some bold action, which is really exciting and moving us forward really quickly. That's Olivia Chow. But I think, yeah, absolutely across the province, it's a crisis. It's very real. And we are not seeing things moving forward as quickly as they should. And, you know, the other thing that we haven't talked about is the fact that the government in Ontario took away some of the tools that municipalities had to be able to move developers along to building the truly affordable housing that we need and to have the funds to be able to service, you know, those developments. So it's a really big problem. And the government has kind of downloaded all the responsibility onto municipalities without actually providing them with the tools that they need.
And in fairness to the provincial and federal governments, the high interest rates from the Bank of Canada have not helped with housing starts. And certainly that's one reason why builders are reluctant to put shovels in the ground when it costs so much to finance these sort of things. I just want to switch gears a little bit and talk about Highway 413. This is, you know, for our nationwide audience, why are we talking about a local highway? But it's been a big issue between the federal government and the province. The feds have just announced that they are not going to do a federal impact assessment on this major piece of road work. And it's causing a lot of controversy in a lot of circles. Environmentalists, local residents worried about a brand new highway going through some very key parts of the province, some farmland, some wetlands. There's a lot of animals, creatures, wildlife that could be affected by such development. What do you make of Ottawa deciding not to put it through that more rigorous federal review and essentially allowing the province to go ahead?
Well, first of all, I'd say the Doug Ford government has a terrible track record, both when it comes to trampling on environmental protections, but also being dishonest about what they're doing. All you have to do is look at what happened with the Green Belt. You know, let's not forget we have a provincial government here right now in Ontario that's being investigated by the RCMP. But also, you know, not just being dishonest about what they're doing, but also who stands to benefit. And Ontarians really do deserve to understand the full cost of this project. It's not just the financial costs, of course. It's also the impact on floodplains and farms and species at risk. So it's very disappointing to see the federal government simply throwing their hands up in the air. They could and they should introduce legislation right now. They could update the Impact Assessment Act. They could redesignate the Highway 413 project under it. And that would be one way that Ontarians could see the full cost of the project.
You saw the blowback Environment Minister Stephen Guilbeault, the federal environment minister, got over his statements that the federal government was getting out of the business of funding roads. He later walked that back and said he just meant certain large projects. Is there not a political price to pay for some politicians who stand in the way of infrastructure projects that could offer quite a bit of relief to a region of the country where gridlock is a big issue. A lot of people spending a long time in their cars to getting to and from work. Why not have this sort of project that would give people some help, some relief?
Yeah, well, first of all, I should say there are other options here, but we're not saying that you don't build roads ever and that we don't need infrastructure. Obviously, we do need to look at those things, and we have a lot of roads and highways in this province right now that are in terrible states of disrepair because the government has again downloaded all of that onto municipalities. But I think it's also an issue that we do have to look at. It's not holding things up, right? We're not trying to stop this. What we need to do is know the full cost of it. And we have farmers, we have species at risk we have a lot of people concerned about those issues, issues around the floodplains that this highway is going to go through that need to be examined, I think, before you take on a project like this. And so I think it's very important that we do that right, because we will otherwise pay the price down the road. And I would also add that this government, we forced a vote here at the legislature a couple weeks ago to get the government to try to make better use of the one big toll highway that we have here, the 407. Yeah. It's privately run and privately collected tolls. And if the government pushed the company and said, no, we're going to move freight trucks over there and make it free for them, we would just immediately relieve an enormous amount of congestion on big highways like the 401. And that's one of the big issues here. So there's a lot of things that this government is choosing not to do, but absolutely, you know, we can build infrastructure, we can do it well, but we also have to understand what the real cost is going to be down the road.
Right. Okay, let's leave it there. Thank you so much, Ontario NDP leader Merritt Stiles. Appreciate your time tonight.
Thank you.
The official opposition failed to topple the government. Yesterday's vote on non-confidence over the carbon tax went nowhere.
The table will now compile the results of the vote.
Yes, 416, 116. Nays, contre, 204, 214.
I declare the motion defeated.
Bloc Québécois and NDP MPs voted with the government to defeat the motion and stave off an election. What will the political fallout be? It's time to bring in the Friday Power Panel. Negan Sinclair is a columnist for the Winnipeg Free Press. The Globe and Mail's Kelly Kreiderman is in Calgary, as is the CBC's Jason Markosoft. And here with me, editorial writer for Le Devoir, Marie Vastel. Kelly, I'm going to start with you. It wasn't much of a nail-biter last night. The Conservatives didn't really come close to taking down the government. But do you think they accomplished anything with this whole effort? Is there something to be said for what they did this week?
I think there was no surprise in the outcome, but I do think it continues on their narrative on the carbon tax and the affordability issues being key for Canadians. And I think that has been very successful for them, you could argue, for 18 months, or at least the last 6 to 8 months, where we saw Pierre Poilievre and the Conservatives really go up in the polls. And I think, you know, this is, you know, they didn't win in the House of Commons, but there'll be a axe the tax rally in a couple days to follow up. And I think this is a war of attrition for Pierre Poilievre, that he will just continue to hammer away at it, knowing that the carbon price, I think, has become a symbol of all the concerns, fairly or unfairly, that Canadians have about affordability, about housing prices, about grocery prices. And you saw that even when Pierre Poilievre talks about the carbon price, he goes on tangents about people not having enough food in the refrigerator and the like. And I think the argument that, you know, the Liberals did this to themselves, the argument that the carbon price is completely neutral, that people get back more than they pay in, while that is true on a fiscal basis, we do have a PBO report that says there is this knock-on effect on the economy that could be to the detriment of many households in many provinces. And the federal Liberals acknowledged as much when they did the carve-out in for home heating fuel last fall.
Yeah, there's like two competing PBO reports. One suggests that 8 of 10 people are better off and that they would be made whole by the rebate. But another report, which takes a more holistic look at the carbon tax, says there's economic effects that could be detrimental to a lot more people. It's not just about covering off what the carbon tax itself is, that there are other costs to the economy and to people's savings and jobs and yada yada. So competing reports, which doesn't give us a lot of clarity, Marie. You know, Poilievre kind of threw everything at the wall this week, right? There was an emergency debate request to the speaker that was turned down. There was an opposition day motion vote this week. There was this non-confidence motion vote. There's the Spike the Hike rally over the weekend in Ottawa this time. And then last weekend, it was Halifax, St. Patrick's Day. You got hundreds of people out in Halifax on St. Patrick's Day to axe the tax, which I thought they might be somewhere else enjoying some libations instead of listening to Pierre Poilievre. But, you know, they tried a lot of things. They really used all of their efforts this week to go after the carbon tax, and they're solely focused on that. Do you think that they are winning this fight on carbon?
I think they've already won it, quite frankly, because of the size of those rallies, but also because this narrative, and Kelly's right, reinforced by the Liberals granting an exemption on oil heating a few months ago, they've created this narrative, and people have endorsed that narrative, that because of the cost of living, carbon pricing is just should just not be a priority, not be policy. To your point on the competing PBO reports, if you ask environmentalists, there's also costs to not doing anything because there's costs with natural disasters and climate disasters. So there's also that to factor in, and that was their rebuttal to the PBO report. But
neither PBO report considers the cost of inaction.
Exactly. So there's a lot of numbers to factor in, but I think that the argument that it's just not sustainable at this point has already gained traction. I mean, when you have Liberal leaders or a Liberal premier in Newfoundland, Liberal leaders in New Brunswick, Nova Scotia, in Ontario, Bonnie Crombie, who was elected in 2008 federally under Stéphane Dion, who had a green shift, which was a carbon pricing mechanism. Mm-hmm. When you have all these people, Liberals, who aren't even fighting to help save the carbon tax anymore, I think you have to admit that the Trudeau government is really starting to be out on their own on this, and that the days of the carbon tax do seem to be numbered. Eventually, maybe not this election, but eventually a cycle will bring conservatives to power and they will get rid of it. And it looks like no provinces are going to want to take over like BC or Quebec and have their own mechanism. So I think the damage has been done, and I think it's just a matter of days or months at this point.
It's wounded and it might be fatal.
And because the government didn't sell their own policy, right? We've said it oftentimes here. They didn't sell it. They didn't sell the rebate. And they didn't sell the cost of inaction. And they also haven't countered lies, quite frankly, by conservatives. Right. For example, they were saying again this week that it's a hike of 23 cents a liter. It's actually 3.3 cents a liter. That's a pretty big difference a liter. So all these counter arguments have not been made, and now it's just too late.
Nigan, your premier in Manitoba isn't really a fan of the carbon tax. He's not really joined this band of some of the other premiers that are asking for the carbon tax to be stopped, the hike to be stopped on April 1st. But he still made it clear he's not really all that on side with it, especially as it comes to home heating oil. What do you make of the federal government essentially ignoring seven premiers at this point, asking them to stop the pause on April 1st, to not spike the hike? What do you make of this decision to just stick it out? We're gonna keep the carbon tax, come hell or high water. We're gonna defend it no matter what. Even if everyone turns on us, we're keeping it. What do you make of that strategy?
This is absolutely the hill that Trudeau is standing right on, willing to die for. We also, to add to Marie, I mean, we have NDP leadership candidates in Alberta who are also in opposition. Mm-hmm. So Premier Wapkinew in Manitoba actually this week was talking about extending gas tax exemptions and sort of mulling openly over removing the Manitoba gas tax exemption. So his attention is certainly being paid to affordability, and he knows the big ticket item, because in about 2 weeks, if the rise of the carbon pricing goes in, they'll be on April 1st, they'll be at the pumps. Canadians will see that. And any talk about any reports or any talk about any rebates will just go out the window, because people will be seeing only their kind of actions at the pumps. What this narrative, and you're right, it is a narrative, and it's full of half-truths or lies, as Marie pointed out, needed a dragon, and in this case, a three-headed dragon, and Poilievre, through a non-confidence action, one simple non-confidence action, instead of proposing policy, which he really has yet to do on anything involving an alternative to carbon pricing, He's been able to paint now the NDP, the Bloc, and the Liberals as sort of a three-headed dragon of the carbon tax, and the campaign slogans just begin to write themselves. They're in full election mode. That's what we saw this week. And in almost full court press election mode, the kind of thing that you see leading up to an election, even though we're looking at like a year and a half away from an election, I think it's just being pushed farther and farther to the maximum possible date, because there's no way that the Liberals are going to be able to move anywhere near thinking about an election when they're constantly playing defensive and, as Marie pointed out, just missing some really low-hanging fruit when it comes to tackling the Conservatives, like the fact their carbon plan is almost null. They've never had to, because when you keep yelling fire in a theater, everyone's turning their heads towards what is the Conservatives doing this week. You never really have to offer anything tangible.
Jason, how do things look from where you're sitting?
So one funny thing about where I'm sitting in Alberta is that we're going to get another change in our fuel at the pumps on April 1st. Because Danielle Smith, as critical as she is of the carbon tax hike and the carbon tax period, is actually going to be increasing by 4 cents to 13 cents a litre the fuel tax. Mm. The very same price
that it would go up.
That Manitoba's cutting. But what kind of world do we live in?
Sorry, okay, she's reversing taxes to come back, right?
So. Yeah, she's reversing the cut. She's phasing out the cut, so gas prices will go, fair enough, will go up by 4 cents per liter on April 1st, ending the nearly 2-year-long full holiday we had from it. She's saying that at the same time, saying people cannot afford, and the 3.3 cent hike on the carbon tax is bringing will break people's backs. So I think there's going to be some maybe more scrutiny of that. They're having to do some elegant arguments on that, but. To the point about, with regards to the non-confidence motion, I don't know how many Conservatives will be thinking of this as a failure. And maybe they're even happier that there was no other party or no other MPs who got along with this, because they can say, we alone will slay, as Negan said, that three-headed dragon. The one thing that they must be mindful of, though, is that the sooner they do go to that election eventually, and think they pretty well know that it's not going to be on the, anytime right away soon with the confidence supply agreement where the way it is, they will have to come out with a climate plan, notionally. I mean, maybe they don't. Maybe they think they're so far ahead in the polls they don't need to convince people or persuade people.
Yeah, do they? I mean, that's the thing. We saw Erin O'Toole come out with an environment plan before the last election campaign, and it didn't really work out that well for him, did it? I mean, because all of us were like, there's going to be a price on carbon under an O'Toole government, mm-hmm. and then there was all these questions about the green savings account and the mm-hmm. carbon tax would go. There was just a lot. I mean, some people might say the opposition party can just kind of dance until an election and maybe not have to come out with something.
Pierre Poilievre seems to be benefiting from the moral clarity that Erin O'Toole didn't seem to have on this, and the simplicity. I mean, it's sort of like he's Carly Rae Jepsen, right? Carly Rae Jepsen has a number of pieces of songs, good songs, but everybody loves Call Me Maybe. And it's like, this is the Canada seems to be a populace right now who only wants to hear Call Me Maybe, and Pierre Poilievre is delivering the hits at rallies, at motions, in ads, everywhere. He's just saying, call me maybe, Canadians.
Kelly, you mentioned 18 months since Poilievre took the throne, if you will, the Conservative throne. And they're up about 18 points in national polls, if we're to believe some of the aggregators and some of the figures that they put out. Do you think that it's the carbon tax that's driving those numbers up, or is it, what is it? I mean, why are they seeing such a big bounce? I mean, is 3 cents a liter at the pump really what's turning so many people onto Poilievre?
Mm-hmm. No, it's not. It's like kind of the last thing, to drop. I think it is housing. It is this inflationary period. It was the sense that the federal Liberals weren't taking those concerns seriously from the beginning. Pierre Poilievre owned that space. He was making videos about $3 million falling down bungalows in Vancouver when the federal Liberals were not paying attention to housing. And as a result of that, he can play the same song all the time in a way, because hammering away on the affordability measure, whether you're talking about housing, an ill-defined plan on housing, or on carbon pricing, it works, because everybody is feeling like every cent matters at this point. And you have to ask, why would Pierre Poilievre lay out a environment plan at this point that would pigeonhole him and restrict his, he would be held to that, whereas he can just keep on the strategy that he's been on in hammering the federal liberals on this issue. And I think, you know, we talk about the conservatives, they do get things wrong about the size of the increases coming, and that is concerning. But they would make the point that the federal liberals have always made the case that climate policies are painless to consumers. And I think what we're seeing is, as the carbon price goes up, as the impact of other regulatory moves on carbon climate policy, like an oil and gas cap, like an EV mandate, those do have a cost. You may very well say, as a Canadian, as a voter, that is worth it. I care about that for climate change. But I think what the affordability issues has started a big pushback against that, and every little thing matters at this point for dealing with that affordability question. Mm-hmm.
Marie, we see at poll after poll that climate has kind of drifted down as a top issue. Affordability, cost of living, now kind of 1 in 2, healthcare always in that top three. But still, a lot of people care about the climate. A lot of people are very worried about what's going to happen to our planet. And you've seen what the liberal strategy is when it comes to carbon, the carbon tax, and Polyev in particular. They're saying he's a climate-denying guy who's going to let the planet burn. Mm-hmm. And he's going to do absolutely nothing for Canada and for the world on this very important issue. Do you think that that's how they can salvage this? Maybe that sort of messaging, maybe more pointed attacks on him as a climate denier. Is that something that could take off?
I mean, it hasn't, right? So that's kind of your answer. I think the Liberals were banking very much on portraying Mr. Poilievre a certain way, and they in French they call him l'âge de pierre, which is like stone age. Stone is pierre in English. It doesn't translate well, sorry. But they do this association of like dinosaur era, nothing for the climate, the planet will burn. But it has not worked, and I think they're at this point, but it's too late, in my opinion, that where they just have to explain the policy and really reinforce what it is and what it is not. But I think Kelly's right. I think there's a lot of factors in why the Conservatives are doing so well in the polls, partly because the Liberals have been there for 8 years, and that's just the way political cycles work. But also, housing, grocery prices, everything being so expensive. I think environment and climate remains top of mind for a lot of voters, but when you can't even fathom buying your first home, unfortunately, priorities shift. And I think the carbon tax has become this sort of thunderbolt, if that's the right word in English, for all these concerns. And in a very simplistic way, the Conservatives have managed to kind of make the carbon tax the symbol of everything that you cannot afford, and it's because of this one thing, and it's very simple to explain and very simple to get rid of. It's much more simple to say we'll get rid of the tax than we will build X amount of houses and it will take this long and this is how the market will work. And it's just not simple, and it's just not easily done. And I think it's the main reason we see right now, but it's not the reason why they're going up in the polls. It's a long coming sort of shift.
And it can stand in for other taxes, right? Like other people who are concerned about other taxes and feeling overburdened by taxes, they just hear the word tax and they're like, taxes are bad. Let's get rid of them, right?
It's also terrible. It's also terrible environmental policy, like overall. I mean, it's not long-term. It's not sustainable. It's politically not feasible. And the Liberals would be much better served to look at environmental sustainability practices. And, you know, every time they make a criticism, so the Liberals are coming out not only just to talk about the fact that the Conservatives don't really have a climate change policy, so they're building Poilievre as this kind of a climate hater, or climate change hater, but they also were painting him as kind of a rich millionaire living in a mansion, all these kinds of things. I mean, the Liberals need to look at the three fingers pointed back. I mean, then the Conservatives said, hey, you took trips to Jamaica on big planes and used all this carbon to fly. And it was, you know, the real problem is that the Liberals have put all of their eggs in the basket on the carbon pricing for an environmental, addressing the climate change. And it just really isn't policy that does short-term impact particularly, but then kind of the ways in which the big ticket items that I think anyone who is interested in supporting climate change or engaging climate change can see some tangible outcomes from. And I think if you were to see, let's say the Liberals invest in climate change initiatives that can help for sustainability, green technology, so on. The problem is also at the same time they just opened up the Trans Mountain pipeline, and there's a real hypocrisy there that is easily picked upon by the Conservatives.
I just want to draw our viewers' attention to St. Patrick's Basilica in Montreal. Former Prime Minister Brian Mulroney is lying in repose. We just saw Stephen Harper enter that basilica to pay his respects. Sorry to interrupt you there, but we just wanted to bring you that image. He's entering the church now as we speak, approaching the casket there in Montreal of Brian Mulroney. Okay, let's change topics as we let's talk about another thing that's going on in Montreal. The fallout from the Liberal governments voting in favor of an amended NDP motion on the Israel-Hamas war. It's the fallout of that is still being felt by one MP in particular, Anthony Howe's father, who represents a Montreal suburb. He says he's reflecting on his future in the party after the Liberal government went along with this motion after making some amendments. Let's listen to Howe's father and what he said about that.
I'm not out there right now engaged in negotiations about anything. I'm just thinking, where do I belong? And again, that vote on Monday is so profound. And what's happened over the last couple of months has been so profound. I just want to believe that I fit in the right place and that my community that I represent fits in the right place.
Jason, so the NDP's motion has stirred up a lot of emotions, including, of course, there from House Father, as you just heard. What do you make of all this talk about him potentially crossing the floor to join the Conservatives?
Well, it's really intriguing, and it would be a major blow for the Liberals. Also confused as to what the political upshot would be and the political optics of him doing this would be in Mount Royal. Mount Royal is a riding that has been Liberal since 1940. So in the big Mulroney days, all through the last, 80-some years of Canadian history, it has been red. Réal Cahuét, the social credit leader, was fond of saying you could paint a mailbox red and it would win a Liberal nomination in that riding. I do wonder if this could change. Anthony Howe's father is a tremendously popular former mayor of, I believe it's Coast St. Luke, another mayor in the Montreal region, the mayor of Hampstead has said he blames Trudeau for a lot and would happily support the Conservatives. And hopefully he thinks it would be Anthony Howe's father. I'm sure Howe's father is going through, as he thinks about this, questions like this issue. I'm aligned with the Conservatives. What about the carbon tax? Yeah. Going back to our last chat, do I want to start rallying the axe the tax crowd? Do I want to hold other positions? Do I want to malign my current Liberal colleagues on some of the things that the Conservatives currently malign the Liberal government on, which is by opposition, into being opposition, most things? But boy, would that be a narrative blow both in Montreal and nationally for the Liberals to actually lose somebody crossing the floor. Has it happened at all this in the Liberals' government spell that they've lost anybody?
Not this session.
Well, they've lost people to move to be independent.
Yeah.
A couple scandals.
But not crossing
floor crossing it.
Marie,
they
Oh, wait, they lost Leona Alislev.
But that was a few years ago
right?
It hasn't happened since the last election.
And not as high profile as Mr.
Marie, I don't think there's been a Conservative on the island of Montreal for, since Mulroney? Speaking of Mulroney, probably since then. What are you hearing from your sources? You talk to a lot of folks on the Hill. Do you think that there's a chance that House Father does cross the floor and really don a new jersey? Is that possible?
I would be surprised. I could see Mr. House Father wanting to sit as an independent. Jody Wilson-Raybould did it, and she won once in Vancouver Granville. She won once and lost the second time. So there is a precedent of hope, I guess, to be elected as an independent. I think he's feeling a lot of pressure. Mayor of Hampstead that you mentioned, his riding, the last numbers I have were from 2019, is the second riding with is the riding in Canada with the second biggest Jewish population. And so there's a lot of pressure on him, and he has been very vocal about his personal convictions and thinking about what's going on in Gaza and in Israel. So, but it's hard for me to see him going with the Conservatives for the reasons Jason mentioned, but also in 2011, the Conservatives ran this like pretty dirty campaign in Mount Royal to get to sort of push Erwin Cutler out, who was like in his 70s at that point, maybe right. late 60s. They made calls. They said he was about to quit and then by-election was imminent, and it really didn't go over very well. And so I find it hard to reconcile that with the writing, the conservative history in the writing. And yeah, I'm not sure he would have a great chance of being elected conservative. If anything, probably a better chance of just being reelected an independent. But, you know, I do think that he's quite tortured. I don't know if it's so much the motion, because when you look at the motion, how it was gutted from what it was originally, it really just reinforces the Liberal government's policy.
Yeah.
Ceasefire being requested, continued funding for UNRWA, and a two-state solution, though that does not seem very plausible, and at this point, sorry, and ceasing further authorization and transfer of arms exports. So we're just not sending new arms, non-lethal equipment. We haven't sold lethal equipment, and we've frozen any new permits since January 8th, so really it's just a continuation. Yeah. I think his feelings were more towards the negotiations, the way it went about, some people applauding Heather McPherson, the NDP MP. I think that's where he really felt like, do I actually belong here? But he's been a Liberal since he was a teenager.
Yeah.
I don't know if he's going to be able to get over this because it is so, so, so deeply rooted. But I don't know if he's upset that much that he actually crosses the floor.
Well, yeah, he was upset by the motion itself, mm-hmm. but it was more than the motion. It was how his Liberal colleagues mm-hmm. reacted to McPherson and cheered the motion's
passage.
And
didn't really bring him in to rewrite it.
And they were caught off guard, I think, too, because the government kind of made some last-minute amendments to that motion, right, and didn't necessarily bring caucus on side with all of those proposed changes. Nigan, what do you make of that motion? The NDP claiming victory this week, saying that they got a big one over on the government by getting them to vote on this, but as Marie just laid out, not a lot of changes to policy expected. It's kind of status quo, even though this vote happened.
No, it kind of harks back to the ways that the Liberals have tried to play this issue in such a way that they don't want to be seen as favoring either side, which actually matches with a lot of polling with Canadians. I mean, most Canadians feel split right down the middle on to whether Canada should take a side on this issue. So the Liberals, this motion, which really doesn't change anything. I mean, people were split. Some people were hyperbolic, mostly on the conservative side, saying, oh, this is now going to ban all weapons, as if we were sending lethal weapons anyways. Mm-hmm. The fact is that this motion really doesn't do a lot, and it really plays going back almost 6, 8 months, the way in which the Liberals have constantly, I mean, Justin Trudeau waited for a long time to even make a statement on the issue itself of what Israel was doing in relation to the attacks by Hamas. And then subsequently for months have been kind of playing this issue. So the real challenge is that House Father was really concerned about the way his lack of involvement on the issue and the way in which the NDP led the kind of motion, even though at the end of the day, the NDP can claim the victory, but really, this is just reinforcing what the Liberals are already doing. I just want to add one thing to what was said earlier. I mean, we have to remember that House Father is a career politician, and yes, he's been a Liberal for decades, but I think a politician does political things. And if he were to cross the floor, this is almost a guaranteed cabinet spot. It's a high profile.
He has to get elected.
Well, I mean, I agree with what you said before. I don't know the intricacies of the riding like you do, but I would say that if there's a high-profile mayor in the area supporting him in his movement towards the Conservatives, and there's a sentiment, I don't think voters have that much memory to remember the intricacies of by-elections. I think there is a possibility to be able to get a foothold in Quebec, and then what you see is you really see a general for the Conservatives and a former Liberal, which plays very nicely into everything Poilievre would like to paint about his party.
Kelly, what are your thoughts on this one?
You know, you've heard Mr. Housefather express concern about Liberal statements on the crisis in the Middle East at other points. But, you know, what is striking watching his interviews this week is how personal and how lonely he felt watching his Liberal colleagues applaud the motion, which, you know, did get amended. But it is to me, a classic example of trying to please everyone and not pleasing anyone. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, it kind of speaks, again, as Nigan says, there is confusion and there are different thoughts on this across Canada, there are evolving thoughts on this. But I think, you know, his point that the Liberals could have voted against this just and not worked on an amendment is also true. And you have to wonder why, you know, we're not talking about pharmacare here. We're not talking about something that was essential to the agreement between the Liberals and the New Democrats, I think. So you have to wonder why there was this compromise on this. And I, you know, at the same time, I think it also speaks to a very quickly evolving situation. If you look at our partners, the other Western countries, you had the German chancellor who was very very strong in his support for Israel several months ago, talking about his concern about the humanitarian disaster in Gaza. You have U.S. President Joe Biden meeting with Israeli officials in Washington next week to discuss the potential invasion of Rafah, and his and more and more discussion about the U.S., which, you know, Canada sells or gives Israel tens of millions of supplies and equipment per year. The United States, we're talking about over $3 billion. So there is, and there is now in the U.S. serious talk of that being a restraint in some way. So I think this is a very evolving situation. And I think the problem is the federal Liberals have never been completely clear in where they stand. We still don't know exactly how this motion will shake out, like what parts of it will be followed, what it exactly means for actual shipments to Israel.
I think whether Mr. Housefather leaves or not, I think this shows that the strategy that we've talked about on this show many times of trying to find the middle ground and appease tensions between both communities at home is sort of getting to a boiling point. Whether he leaves or not, he is a valued member of caucus. He's been there for a long time. Mm-hmm. He's a very vocal member of caucus, not just on this, on language issues in Quebec.
A lot of stuff,
He's respected by his friends. And everyone this week was saying, oh, he's my friend. I hope he doesn't leave.
He speaks to the press a lot, too, right? Yeah. He's very friendly to the media. Like, he's always willing to take questions.
Just the fact that he's considering leaving, and there's a big protest in Montreal in support of Palestinians living in Gaza, I think this... it indicates that this middle ground is just, it's not sustainable, and we're sort of reaching a new level of tension and discontent on both sides that this government is going to have to figure out how to manage sooner rather than later, I think.
Okay, let's leave it there. Let's leave it there, guys. Thank you so much to the Power Panel. Marie Vestel, Jason Markusoff, Kelly Kreiderman, and Egon Sinclair. Good discussion tonight, guys. Thank you so much.
Welcome back to Power and Politics. I'm David Cochrane in Montreal, outside Notre Dame Basilica, where tomorrow the funeral service for the Right Honourable Brian Mulroney will take place. But tonight, Canada's 18th Prime Minister is lying in repose at St. Patrick's Basilica. And that is where, for the past 2 days, the Mulroney family has been, meeting people who have traveled from across the country to pay their respects. Now, St. Patrick's Basilica is an important church in the Mulroney family. This is where Ben Mulroney and his wife Jessica Mulroney were married. And earlier today, I met with Ben Mulroney at the church to talk about his father and his father's legacy. Ben Mulroney, it's nice to meet you. I wish it was under happier circumstances,
nice
but thank you,
too,
for your time today. You've been going through a very personal thing, but in a very public way.
Yeah.
How has that been for the family?
Well, I'm glad you said that, because I think everybody who goes through grief, There's a commonality to it. This is unique, but I think this is unique and to our benefit. The fact that we can stand here and have people from all walks of life, from Montreal, Ottawa, and points on in between, people from the international community, the diplomatic corps, regular Canadians, all coming in with stories, a lot of them saying, thank you for sharing my father. That's quite therapeutic. It allows us to know him even better. And we knew him best. So for perfect strangers to come in and help us know someone we knew best helps us probably grieve a little better, more effectively, more deeply.
We see that, right? You know, in lying in state in Ottawa, lying in repose here, thousands of people coming through, and we can see them talking to you and shaking your hands, but we can't hear them.
Yeah.
Is there a particular story, a particular moment that has struck with you?
Well, in Ottawa, what struck me was the stories from the high commissioners and the ambassadors who are coming in with so much more than just the standard stock our condolences. So many of them came with stories of decisions my dad or his government made back in the day that are still yielding positive results for the people of that country. So whether it was the Ukrainian ambassador thanking dad for being one of the first to recognize the independence of Ukraine, despite the protests from Americans, right. Might add. Same with Estonia and the other Eastern Bloc countries. I think the ambassador, high commissioner from Barbados, remembered that dad forgave the debt that allowed them to finish building their airport. He said, every time I go through the airport, I thank Brian Mulroney. And there were so many stories like that. So that was Ottawa. And then here, I mean, there's so many personal stories of people meeting him when he walked down the street or in a restaurant or at a shoe shine. And my favorite was a woman yesterday who said, I didn't vote for your dad, never want to vote for your dad. And then she took a beat and she said, and I got it wrong, I'm sorry. Mm-hmm. And then she was right next to my brother who knows how to take a sad moment and make it funny. He said, well, he's right there, you can go apologize.
He would have loved that.
Yeah, though, he would have loved that, yeah.
But it's been remarkable to watch it. You know, we've been covering it obviously on television, and to watch it, and we saw you there in Ottawa shaking all the hands of everybody that went in. And then hours later, I looked at the television screen and you were all still there. I said, that can't be live. Yeah. Just hours and hours and hours, a sense of duty to meet the moment.
Well, I think originally there was a plan for us to do things in shifts. And obviously you can see right now that's where we all have different things that we're taking care of. But while we were there and here for the last 3 days, to chalk it up to my mother, who said, if these people are going to brave the cold, if they're going to take time out of their lives to come see dad, we're going to be here to meet them. And so we said, all right, so right next to her, you're going to find us. And it was, there was no hard decision or conversation about it. It was this is what, they deserve that. They deserve our respect because they're coming to pay theirs.
How is she holding up in all of this? The 5 decades together,
I have to assume I'm experiencing my own version of loss. Mm-hmm. She's experiencing something even, I think, greater. But she's tough. She comes from good Serbian stock. And so my dad would be the first to say that he accomplished very little in life without her. He would have been the most successful senior partner at his law firm were it not for her. She was the one that took him to the place where he always wanted to go. And so, which means we wouldn't be doing this here today without her. She is the toughest woman I know. She is the smartest woman I know. She brings us together. She is she's the heart and soul of the family. I think that we are going through, I think we're busy enough right now that the sorrow doesn't permeate everything. And we also have 16 grandkids here right now. Yeah. So the noise drowns out the sadness. That'll come later.
Yeah, there's a propulsion and a momentum to the ritual that carries you through all of this.
She's going to, I think when we lay him to rest and she has some time to be alone, that it might be in that moment. But I think in that moment we'll all be in the next phase of this.
It's a moment of reflection, and as we've learned since news of your father's death emerged, it's also been a period of reconciliation. Lucien Bouchard was here yesterday, and I remember being on the air on February 29th, and people thought that is a moment that never would have happened. How important was your father to have that reconciliation near the end?
Well, I think the stories of his kindness are myriad, and there are a lot of people who were let back in to his good graces who, I don't know, maybe didn't deserve it or didn't deserve it as quickly as he let them in, but that's who he was. With Lucien Bouchard, I think that was a different kind of hurt, and I think they both felt it was so great that they might not be able to overcome it. And I think it was a unique pain in his life. And so for him to be able to have repaired that relationship, and repaired it completely, I might add, even though it was late, and I'm sure they would both have regrets that it happened too late, but they did it. They did it. And it was one less thing for him to carry. And he was carrying a lot near the end. So I'm sure that that lightened his load, and that made him, probably completed him in a lot of ways.
When we look back, as we have over his public life, his time in politics, when you're in politics, what people say about you can often be quite mean and quite cruel. But over time, as you get away from the intensity of the moment, more reflective and assessing accomplishments and legacies. And the current prime minister talked about advice your father gave him about people are going to remember the big things. That's been a lot of that. How do you think your father would feel about the way the big things he tried and did and sometimes wasn't able to do? How do you think he'd feel about the way those are being remembered right now?
I think he'd be smiling right now. I think, you know, I have no doubt for him it wasn't easy. I have no doubt that it hurt. And I remember some of the things I read and some of the things I saw on TV. Even as a young boy, I knew that wasn't right. I thought there were some really low blows at the time. But he had a guiding principle that the political capital was meant to be spent on those big things. He always said, if you retire at 90% of the polls, you've done something wrong. It means you're hoarding that capital and you didn't use it for to help to enact whatever vision it is that you have. And he wanted to make sure he spent every last drop of it. And, you know, he used to joke when he was at 12% in the polls. He said, you know, the one thing I do miss about politics, the adulation. And that doesn't necessarily hold true today. But he was comforted. He really did believe that if he left it all out there, that in a generation or so, Canada would be better off. We are now in that next generation. And hearing from these people, and reading the articles that I'm reading, you'd be hard-pressed to say he was wrong. I think he was right.
When you look at it, though, big things, his whole career is punctuated with them, right? And so much so that you forget about some of them. Like you mentioned about Canada and Poland, the first countries to recognize a potential independent Ukraine. We talked a lot about apartheid in South Africa, acid rain, the Montreal Protocol, free trade. Mm-hmm. Is there one thing that you think he was most proud of in his time in public life?
Well, I think his fight against apartheid really stands out. His aid in the Ethiopian famine, the Peter Milgaard case was one that really stands out. Somebody said a couple of days ago, and I think this is why I'll double back to what we were just talking about. Somebody said, you know, it's very easy to disagree with your enemies, but it's, you know, true leaders are able to disagree with their friends. And so how he stood up to Margaret Thatcher and Ronald Reagan on the question of apartheid, I think really speaks to him as a leader on the foreign stage, on the international stage, and those interpersonal relationships that he was able to navigate and negotiate so that he could still stand firmly in principle on behalf of Canada, what Canada stood for. Still maintain those friendships, still maintain that level of respect, still communicate with those people by saying, on this point, we are fundamentally disagreeing and we are going to do what is right for us as a country.
You mentioned the interpersonal relationships. I never covered your father. I spoke to him once. He called into the show on January 11th when Ed Broadbent passed away. Rosemary Barton set it up, and he wanted to do that, and he was in hospital.
He was. He had a great respect for Ed Broadbent. He had great respect for John Turner, and you've seen the fiery exchanges. These were men who I think were cut from a different cloth. I think for them, listen, there are always lessons that can be learned, and people can change and people can grow. I do hope that there's a certain type of politician today who would appreciate that you can disagree fiercely, vehemently, passionately, but still have respect at the end of the day. Still have respect for that person that you were fighting against. And they did too, even though, you know, my dad came out on the winning side, more often than not, there was kindness from them towards him. There was no animosity. There was no venom. And I think there's some politicians today who could probably pull that off. I'd like to see more of them. And hopefully after let's call it a celebration like this, hopefully people will be able to pull that lesson into their own lives.
It's missing, isn't it? It's really needed.
It is. I'm hopeful for politics in the future. I do love it when people feel called to politics. You know, I think it should be viewed as a calling, and that's what it was for my dad. He certainly didn't do it for the paycheck. He did it because he had a vision for Canada, and I hope more people view it as a calling and take it as seriously as he did.
It's been a long time for your family to get to this point. 3 weeks almost with the funeral set for tomorrow. What do you hope Canadians take away from the service tomorrow, saying goodbye to your father?
Well, I think everyone who speaks is going to speak from a place of deep personal connection to my father. It's going to be, I think you'll hear genuine stories and genuine emotion. I think there's going to be a lot of music. I really do hope there are going to be some laughs in there, because I'm going to need it. I'm going to need a little humor to punctuate the sadness. And but I hope people are left with the sense of a man who, at the end of his life, lived a full and complete life. He was satisfied with the life he led, and he always said, he said, "I'm going to leave it to historians to write my legacy." And I hope tomorrow people get a sense of what that legacy is, especially when they see his 16 grandkids, because for him that was probably the most important thing that he ever did in his life. I hope they get a sense of joy out of it all, because he was a joyful man and we had a joyful life because of him.
On the night he passed, former Prime Minister Jean Chrétien spoke to reporters on Parliament Hill, and he gave what I thought was the best tribute you can give of anybody at the end of the life. He said his children can be proud of their father. Yeah. And I think that's what we all want as parents, and it's clear it's true.
Well, he had wise words from a wise man.
Ben Mulrooney, my deepest sympathies. Thank you for sharing your time with us at this difficult time.
David, I appreciate it. Thank you very much.
Thank you, sir.
That was a beautiful conversation. David, thanks for bringing that to us. I think every father wants their son to speak of them like Ben just did there. David, what are you expecting tomorrow? The funeral, as you said, finally tomorrow. Lots on the agenda. What are you expecting?
Yeah, the funeral is set to start at 11 o'clock in the morning tomorrow. You'll see the procession as Brian Mulrooney and his family come from St. Patrick's Basilica, where he's lying in repose tonight, here to Notre Dame Basilica. It's a short distance, but it's going to be a long and somber one, I think, for the family. Our coverage is going to start on that tomorrow, JP, at 9 a.m. Eastern Time. Rosemary Barton's going to be sitting here hosting our special coverage, our chief political correspondent. And the service will begin at around 11. And we're expecting to hear some more of those speeches that Ben Mulrooney was talking about that he hopes are punctuated with some joy and some jokes, so because he says he's going to need some laughs. We're going to hear from his sister, Caroline Mulrooney, who's going to be giving a eulogy on behalf of the family. She, of course, has followed in her father's footsteps into politics, serving as the Treasury Board Minister in the Ontario government of Doug Ford. She'll be speaking tomorrow, as will Jean Charest, former Premier of Quebec, a cabinet minister in Brian Mulrooney's government, and Wayne Gretzky, the hockey legend and friend of the family, will also be speaking. And JP, 1984 was a high watermark for Wayne Gretzky. He had 208 points that season playing for the Edmonton Oilers. Brian Mulrooney beat him. He had 211 seats in the 1984 federal election. So that's just a sense of the people we're going to hear from tomorrow as the country says goodbye to its 18th prime minister.
Two records that are very difficult to beat. Thank you so much, David Cochran in Montreal tonight.
Thanks, JP.
As David mentioned, CBC News will have special coverage of the state funeral for Brian Mulrooney. David Cochran will be joining host Rosemary Barton, CBC's chief political correspondent. That begins tomorrow at 9 a.m. Eastern on CBC News Network and CBC Television. You can also stream it wherever you get CBC News. That's it for today. If you like this episode, please follow the pod and catch our next live show on CBC News Network. We're on weekdays at 5 p.m. Eastern. I'm JP Tasker. Thanks for listening.
For more CBC podcasts, go to cbc.ca/podcasts.